Up to Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud Beis. Again, this pasuk was talking about the various well, pasuk Yud Aleph, we talked about the various the Atzei Almogim that was transported from Ofer, and we mentioned that the pasuk emphasizes the fact that it was Hevi Me Ofer, which is a very long trip, to indicate that they used up valuable ship space on the Atzei Almogim, even though they were transporting gold, because this stuff was actually more valuable than the gold. Vayas HaMelech as Atzei Almogim, and the Melech made the Atzei Almogim Misod the Beis Hashem, a walkway for the Beis Hashem, the Beis HaMelech, the Kinoros and the Volim, and musical instruments, harps and whatever they are, Lasharim, to the singers, the musicians. There's actually an interesting machlokas in halacha. We know the Levium in the Beis HaMikdash, one of their jobs was the music, the singing. They had instruments and there was singers. And the question is whether the instruments were the ikur or the singing was the ikur. And this is one of the psukim that's brought in this debate, because here you find the expression lasharim, the singers, but it talks about instruments. Kinoros and Nevalim. So that's an indication that the Iker music is through the instruments, not through the voice. I've always said that there's a halacha mentioned in the Gemara that if a Levi does the wrong job, there were Sharim and Sharim. Sharim were like the people in charge of the gates and the gatekeepers, the maintenance of the building, the Beis HaMikdash, and the singers. So if a guy was assigned to be a shorim and he sang, or if he was assigned to sing, it was a shorer, he's chayiv misa, misa b'dei shemayim. So I always thought, I understood the shorim who were going to be singing. If I sang in the Beis HaMikdash, I'm a Levi, you know, I understand why I would be chayiv misa b'dei shemayim. But I'm not sure the other way around. But so this pasuk is one of the sources that potentially is relevant to this discussion of the instruments. Lobake Atzei Almogim, there never was such a shipment of Atzei Almogim, v'lo nira, nor was it ever seen, ad hayom hazeh. This is an extraordinary, and usually either extraordinary quality, or extraordinary quantity, or both, but there was never such a precedent, and nor did it ever happen again. Pasuk Yud Gimel, v'hamelech Shlomo Nosan, Lemalka Shiva, and the King Shlomo gave to the Queen of Shiva as Kol Cheftzo Asher Shala all the desires that she had asked for. Milvada Asher Nosan Lo Kiyad HaMelech, besides that which he gave her according to the hand of the King HaMelech Shlomo. Vatefen Vatelech, she turned and she went La'artza to her land, he Vavadar, she and her servants. So the there is again as a question as to what exactly was going on here. He gave her everything she asked, besides that which he gave her, Kiyad HaMelech Shlomo. So Rashi learns that the first part of the pasuk, Nasan Lo Eskol Cheftza, is referring to Chachma. All the questions she asked, all the requests that she made, in terms of Chachma, tell me how this works, teach me about this, teach me about that, Shlomo gave to her, and taught her whatever it is that she wanted to know. Besides the material gifts that he gave Kiyad HaMelech, because you know there's a certain protocol that if a royalty you know comes to visit, so you exchange gifts. So we mentioned before the vast gifts that Malka Shva gave to Shlomo. Shlomo gave gifts back as well. Some Mefarshim learned that the gifts that Shlomo gave back were equal to or greater in value than what Malka Shva gave him. He didn't want Malka Shva to think that he needed her money. And it's based on the pasuk of Divrei Hayamim. Pashup Shad is not so, but either case, he gave her what you might call protocol gifts. Now, the Chachma is mentioned first because it's more important. Because what Shlomo gave her monetarily is no big deal. What he gave her in terms of Chachma is much greater. For various reasons. First of all, Chachma is really more lasting than wealth. Through Chachma one can attain and perhaps more importantly retain wealth. You know the saying, a fool and his money are soon parted. If a person doesn't have Chachma, then his money really doesn't serve much purpose. And for that matter, life itself doesn't serve much purpose. And that's... it's brought down in the Mefarshim that the first bracha that we make in Shemona Esrei, after the first three brachas, are brachas praising Hashem. Right? The last three brachas are thanking Hashem. The middle brachas are the ones where we make our requests. So what is our first request? It's Das. Ata Chalon Olam Das. Because without Deya, everything else doesn't count. The Gemara really says that. Dabe hakalbe, if you have Deya, then you have everything. Les dabe mabe, if you don't have any Deya, then you have nothing. So that's the more fundamental. In an even deeper sense, Chachma can give, doesn't have to, but it can give meaning to life and satisfaction to life, whereas money cannot. The nature of money, unless you have Chachma, and sometimes even if you do, is that it creates more tsar than satisfaction, more pain than satisfaction. First of all, Chazal tell us, Yesh lo mana rotzu masayim. A person has 100, he wants 200. Right? People say the richer you are, the poorer you are. Because if you have 100 and you want 200, you're only missing 100. But if you have 1,000 and you want 2,000, you're missing 1,000. And if you have 55 billion or whatever it is that Bill Gates has, then you're missing 55 billion. That's poor. Right? That you're quite short of your goals. So if you think it's somewhat of an exaggeration, again, it is extreme. It depends on the person, but there's a phenomenal expression of this in the Chovos HaVavos in Shara Bechina. Chovos HaVavos says, he's explaining the reasons why people don't naturally feel more hakaras hatov, more gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because Baruch Hu gives you everything that you have, and yet, it's a big job for people to feel thankful. Why is that? So he goes through a number of reasons. But one of the reasons he says is that when a person has something, he doesn't appreciate what he has because he wants more. Kikol asher yagil mimenu al maila. If anybody reaches any level in Gashmias, mivakshem mashu lemailu mimenu, he wants a still higher level. He's not satisfied what he reaches, he wants more. V'dorshem mashu acharel, and you're looking for that which comes after that. V'tima'atenu beinehem, and therefore it will be very small in your eyes. Hatovos harabos, the great goods. V'tiktanenu etzlan, you'll minimize them. Hamatonos hagdolos, the great gifts. Ad shehem choshvim, until a person reaches the level, if it's unchecked, a person reaches the level called tova sheyesh lizulasam, any good they see in the world, any money, any wealth, any power, any honor, anything that you see in the world, lizulasam, that somebody else has, ke'ilu nishtala mehem, you begin to feel as if it was taken away from you. There's a person literally wants the entire world. And anything that's out there that he doesn't have somehow bothers him, as if it was taken out of his chelek. And that which you do have, you find it to be bad because it's nothing compared to what you think you should be having. And therefore you don't understand the actions of God who is really doing good to you. The Tov HaLevana, one of the Mefarshim, puts it very succinctly. He says, "Miteva b'nei Adam, it's the nature of a person, lachshav shekol hatov asher roa b're'ehu, that any good he sees in his friend, gazel hu me'ita, is stolen from him, v'shehakol bara Hashem lichvoda." Now we make a bracha at a chasna, shehakol bara lichvoda. Who's covered? Everything was created for his cover. It's supposed to be referring to Hashem. But people somehow think it's referring to themselves. Shakal bara lichvado, everything was created for my honor, and therefore, whatever it is that I don't have is stolen. You literally have the feeling as if it is stolen, as if somehow it's taken away from you. And although that's perhaps an extreme, it's really true. If you really honestly think about it, people feel that way. Maybe not about the whole world, but certainly with something they have shakas to. If a competitor is doing well in business, it's my money. Even if it's not a competitor, a neighbor. He's in a different line of business. Somehow you feel, guy walks, comes, drives home one day with a fancy new car, and you're still driving the old, beaten up old. It's like, take it away from me. Nishlal mimena. So therefore, money doesn't provide satisfaction. It's chachma that provides satisfaction, possibly. Not that chachma can't be abused as well, but at least it has the potential, the possibility of providing that satisfaction. There's more to it. We were talking now about how a person wants more than what he has. But even that which he does have creates problems. As Chazal say, mar ben nechasim, mar ben daga. The more property you have, the more worries you have. Because a person worries about losing that which he has. And there's a psychology involved in that as well. And that is the increase of needs. I put needs in quotation marks. People need every penny they have. It doesn't matter how much it is. People could have enough money that if they just bought treasury bonds, they wouldn't be able to spend the interest in their lifetime, and they worry about every nickel. And they're afraid that they're going to lose money. You know, you think about it. Whatever a person gets used to becomes a need. And it's whether it's his lifestyle, whether it's his security blanket, whether it's the kavod, whatever that money represents to him becomes his need. And I'll give you a simple sort of mashal. A person starts off in life, let's say, and he's trying to make a career, but he starts off, you know, at the bottom of the ladder, isn't making that much money, and he's renting a small apartment, and the apartment's getting a little bit too small, and he's hoping he can move into a bigger apartment. Well, he gets a promotion at work, gets a raise, now he's able to afford a bigger apartment, but it's still an apartment, he has no equity, you know, this, after a while, he wants to buy a house. So he scrapes together enough money, you know, for a down payment, he mortgages it up to the kazoo, now he's got all these monthly payments to make, but he moved into a house. But after a while, the house is too small. Maybe it's because his family got bigger, maybe not. But the house becomes too small. He wants to get a bigger house, maybe in a nicer neighborhood. But it's more expensive. However, you know, there's some appreciation in his house. Maybe right now is not the best time for this. You know, wait for better market conditions. But in the meantime, he's been getting more raises in his business. You know, maybe he's in a little better shape and he buys the bigger house. But after a while, he says, you know, he's stuck in this house 12 months a year, not so geschmack. So he buys a house, a summer home. Right, so now he's got his winter home, he's got his summer home, you know, probably other things that go along with it, and he suffers a severe setback. So now he's got to move back into that, let's say even that first house. There was a time when he was in an apartment, and he was saving up money to buy that house, and this was the most spectacular thing. And when he was finally able to buy that house, he was ecstatic. This was great. But now that he has the bigger home and the summer home and everything else, he has to sell that stuff and move back to that first house. It's a terrible tragedy. The exact same thing that was once a cause for celebration is now a cause for mourning. Why? Same house. The answer is, you got used to something else. Once upon a time, that house was a terrific goal to strive for. And when you got it, you were extremely happy for a short period of time. Till you got used to it. Now it's a tragedy. The exact same thing. So needs are subjective. They're not objective. They don't depend on what you actually have. I once saw an article, and I am very sorry that I didn't save it. It was a secular article. It was describing how some people in America live. It took me, about halfway through the article, I caught on. I guess some people it takes a little shorter, a little longer. It's under such terrible conditions that he said they didn't even have plumbing in the house. He had to go to an outhouse in the back. And, anyway, they're describing the conditions. Basically, they were describing the conditions of a person living in a mansion in the 1870s or something like that. So if you have your own outhouse in the backyard, that was, you know, quite chashuv. Right? And the, you know, the giveaway where they started talking about he couldn't afford a car, he only had this old transportation, which is 4 horsepower. Yeah, right? It was 4 horses. But the point being that what somebody lived, if somebody had today, had to live like they lived in the 1870s, like the rich people in the 1870s, it would be disastrously poor. Because you get used to certain things and you have certain expectations. So a person's needs increase as their money increases. And I remember a story, hopefully nobody could figure out who it is. The person is no longer alive, actually, so it makes it a little bit better. But a fellow was a businessman, and we're going back to, I forgot which one of the Arab oil boycotts. It was in 73, but it might have been... Yeah, and then there's one later again, like 78 or 79 or something.
It wasn't as bad.
Yeah, but I think this was the first one, in 73. So you know the story, you know, United States was supportive of Israel in the 73 war, and then the Arab countries started an oil boycott against the United States. It caught them by surprise, or and it was quite by surprise, but unprepared, let's put it that way. And there were shortages of gasoline. So they had a gasoline rationing system, and the way it worked was each day of the week was assigned. Alternate days were even number days, and other days were odd number days. And it went by the last digit in your license plate. If it was an even number, you could buy gas on the even number days. And if it was an odd number, you could buy gas on the odd number days. And certainly at the beginning of this rule, they were really trying to enforce it. They sent out undercover agents, you know, to buy on the wrong day. And if a gas station got caught, they were shut down. Enormous fines. So people pretty much kept it, at least at the beginning. After a while, things started easing off. You know, there was a fellow, he was, I don't know exactly his business, I was somewhat younger then, you know, but I didn't know him, and his business involved, he used to sell, like, this high-tech, he had a company that used to sell this high-tech equipment to mostly defense and aerospace industries. Now, today it's hard for people to remember, but back in the 70s, there was a lot of that stuff in the New York metropolitan area. There were a number of companies out in Long Island, there were companies in Connecticut and New Jersey, And there are quite a few of these companies. They weren't in New York City itself, but in the outlying areas. And these were his customers. And he used to basically go drive from his company, wherever it was, I think it was also located in Long Island, to all these different customers and meet with the people and the CEOs and whoever it was that he was meeting with. It was not unusual for him to use up a tank of gas in a single day. The fellow was extremely wealthy. He was one of the biggest philanthropists in Queens. Not the biggest, but up there. And so he did quite well. He comes into shul Friday night after the first week of this rationing, and the guy looked like, as they say, like death warmed over. He looked terrible. And people were coming over to him, "Are you okay? Are you well?" What was his problem? Ein Mazel, the poor guy, he had 2 cars, both even numbers. So there were certain days he could not get gas. Didn't matter what he was ready to pay. So he was going crazy. He had to go out to Groton, Connecticut to meet with the shipbuilders, and then he had to go back to New Jersey and from there to Long Island. So, you know, he was doing all kinds of things. He would stay up to midnight, 12:01, he'd get gas. He used to meet his wife on the Long Island Expressway, leave her the car that was almost empty and pick up the other car that was almost full. And he was just running around like a meshugana. He was not a youngster, you know, it wasn't so easy to do. And he looked terrible. And it's a good thing this thing only lasted a couple of weeks. I think it would have lasted much longer, you know, it would have been all over. And I was thinking, the man is making a fortune of money. He's doing quite well. This was pre-cell phone days, all right? There were no cell phones back in 1973, but there were telephones. I know my children don't believe that, but, you know, you had electricity when you were growing up? I don't tell them, we had telephones, we had to turn the dials. I recall my father and my father-in-law were probably one of the last holdouts for dial telephones. I remember once when my oldest was about 7 years old coming to visit, and she had to make a phone call, 8 years old. So okay, you could call from the, you know, from the phone. She picks up the phone and she says, "How does this work? What do I do?" But there were phones. Couldn't he have gotten on the phone? Here he has a long-standing customer in the Groton shipyards. Couldn't he have gotten on the phone and said to the fellow, "Listen, you know, I'm having trouble with the gas rationing. I won't be able to make it, you know, tomorrow. Can we reschedule?" What would happen? Life would go on. Do you really think he would lose a customer? Are people that unreasonable? He's got a product to offer. And let's say he did lose a customer. What would happen to his business? So instead of making $1 million a year, he'll make $800,000 a year. In 1973 dollars. He's not going to be in the poorhouse. What's the big deal? Is it worth your health? Is it worth that agmas nefesh? That worry, the difficulty? The answer is, yeah, because he needs every penny he has. Mar b'nechasim, mar b'daga. That's human nature. And it takes a great deal of chachma to overcome that. I once overheard a conversation here in Kew Garden Hills. I don't know the people. I don't know if they're in this room or not. If you're the ones, you could identify yourself. But I was in shul, one of the shuls in the neighborhood, Mincha Maariv. I guess it must have been between Mincha Maariv. Hopefully, it wasn't during davening. I don't remember exactly. I hear these two people talking, and they're talking about a third party. And clearly, from the conversation, the third party was a doctor, whose wife, I couldn't get straight if the wife was also a doctor or some type of a professional. And they had a son who learned in yeshiva for a number of years and was now a rebbe. And they're talking to each other about this third people. The question one guy asked the other was, how are they taking it? You know, how are they coping with the failure that they have, that their son is not a professional, he's a rebbe. So the other fellow said, "I don't know, he has a pretty good attitude." He was telling me, he said, "Listen, he says, I'm a doctor, my wife's a professional, we make a good living, I have a nice house. I also have a summer house. And I travel, I go to Israel, I go to Europe. You know, we do a lot of things. But it costs a lot of money. At the end of the month, I'm scrambling to pay the bills." He says, "My son lives in a small little house, has an old car, no vacation homes, doesn't go traveling, you know, doesn't buy all these extras. And at the end of the month, he also scrambles to pay the bills. But he's happy with what he's doing." He says, "What's the difference? What's the difference having all that money? You have all that money and you have all these needs. I need my vacation, I need my trip to Israel, I need my trip to Europe, I need the new cars, I need this, I need that. And you scramble to pay the bills." He says, "He doesn't need so many things. He also scrambles to pay the bills, but he's happy with what he's doing. What's wrong with that?" Mar b'nechasim, mar b'daga. So the idea that, you know, the chachma has the potential and the possibility of creating meaning in one's life, but money really doesn't unless that money is directed and controlled by chachma. And it's easier said than done. We all think if we had enough money, you know, it would work out. I was just recently told of a psak Rosh Yeshiva issued a number of years ago. And I know the person upon whom, you know, I knew about this psak, but I didn't know all the details. There's a fellow who is, currently he's a rebbe, he's a Marbitz Torah, and I won't mention any details. His father, Olav Hashem, was a very, very successful businessman. And when he was getting ready to leave the yeshiva, his father offered him, in essence, $5 million to set up a business. And he was anticipating an income. Of course, easier said than done, but let's not go there. He figured he's going to be making $1 million a year off of this business. So he had this idea. He said, "Maybe it's worth it for me to take this business. There's no reason why I have to become a Marbitz Torah, a Rebbe, whoever it may be. I'll take the business, make $1 million, and give $500,000 to tzedakah. And I have $500,000I'll keep for myself. So $500,000 tzedakah is a big thing. So maybe that's a better thing to do. And he spoke to a pretty chush of a person and said, you know, it is a good idea. You have this opportunity to have business and you'll be about tzedakah. So he asked somebody to ask the Rosh Hashiva for him. So the Rosh Hashiva said he's not going to give the tzedakah. He said, but he says he will. He says he will, but he won't. Until you have the money, you think you're going to give it away. But once you have the money, you need it. Marvin Chesed Maradog, it's not so easy. If you have a rich person who gives significant tzedakah, you should admire him. Everyone thinks, if I had that kind of money, I'd be giving more tzedakah. Chances are, if you had that kind of money, you'd be giving less tzedakah. If it were true that you were giving more, maybe Hashem would have given you the money. It's not so easy. So that Rosh Hashiva kept on saying he's not going to give tzedakah. So the fellow said, I can't go back to him with that answer. Right? He's convinced that he will give the tzedakah. I can't go and say, no, you shouldn't do it because you're not going to give the tzedakah. But I am going to give the tzedakah. So let's say he was going to give the tzedakah. What would be the halacha? So Rosh Hashiva looked at him and said, you're not mechuyev that much mesiris nefesh for the mitzvah of tzedakah. In other words, the way he looked at it is, if you want to devote your life to Torah, you're going to have a happy, satisfying life. If you're going to devote yourself to business, sure, you'll have the money, but it'll be marba nechasa marba dagger. You're going to have a miserable life, and you'll be able to be mekayem the mitzvah tzedakah. You're not mechuyev to go to that extreme and to make yourself miserable for the rest of your life just so you could be mekayem the mitzvah tzedakah. How much do you expect of a person? Because Rahu doesn't expect a person to be that much. If you happen to have the money, of course, you're mechuyev to give to tzedakah. But to put yourself into such a miserable situation just so that you should be mekayem the mitzvah tzedakah, you don't have such a responsibility. You don't have such a chiyuv. So that was his psak. So the fellow is not rich. And but as far as I know, he's happy. I haven't seen him in a number of years. I actually ran into him about, how many years ago was it? Must have been 4 or 5 years ago. He seemed happy to me, at least. But the point is that it's not a recipe for happiness. It's interesting to note, by the way, I think the founding fathers of our country thought that it was. You know, the famous inalienable rights in our Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That was a chiddush. The pursuit of happiness was invented by the founding fathers. It was probably the beginning of American politics, because it was basically a soundbite, a public relations ploy. The philosophical underpinnings upon which the Declaration was based was the works of John Locke and other philosophers. They didn't talk about the pursuit of happiness. They talked about the inalienable rights, life, liberty, and property. And actually, it was a legalistic concept. The idea was that a government should preserve the rights of life, liberty, and property. They're not getting into people's personalities. What makes you happy? What doesn't make you happy? What's proper? What's not proper? It was a very much belief in an individual's right to choose. And these are the protections that a person should have from the government. So that's life, liberty, and property. But they were afraid if they said property, it would sound as if this whole revolution was just a matter of money. Oh, you know, the British are charging too much taxes and you want the money yourself. That might have very well been true, but it doesn't sound good. They wanted something ringing, something that sounds philosophical, that sounds lofty. So they substituted, instead of property, the pursuit of happiness. But what does that tell you? That tells you, in their minds, they equated property with the pursuit of... What's the closest phrase we can have to property that doesn't sound so venal? That doesn't sound so selfish? So they came up with the pursuit of happiness. So I think it's a mindset that somehow money equals happiness. In real life, there's no such correlation. Money creates great challenges to happiness. Many people wish they had that challenge, but that's only until they have it. Money creates great challenges to happiness. It is possible to overcome them if with chachma. But without chachma, then you're in trouble. So there is, therefore the chachma came first before the money. There are some variations to explain this pasuk. The Ralbag interprets the entire pasuk as talking about chachma. He doesn't garbage the money altogether, and he says that the eskol chepsa refers to the requests that Malka Shva made after the initial meeting. She came back with sort of specific additional requests. Can you teach me about this? Can you tell me about that? But Ashenosla Kiyat HaMelech Shlomo refers to the original meeting where he answered all her riddles. So there were two parts to the chokmah that he gave her. Shlomo could have just answered the riddles, proved how smart he was, and that's it. But he didn't do that. He responded to all her requests. The Abarbanel is the opposite. Abarbanel learns that the entire pasuk is talking about money, about Gashmias. And he's saying that the king, Melech Shlomo, gave her these protocol gifts, Kiyat HaMelech. And then she asked for additional things because she saw things in Eretz Yisrael that were not available in her country. So she was asking for those things as well, and Shlomo Melech gave her that too. Then it says, "Vatefen vatelech la'artze hiva v'deha." So first of all, the word "vatefen," she turned and she went, is kind of strange. She should have just said that she went to Vatoshav. And also, it's not necessary to say hiva v'deha. Obviously, she went back with her servants. So the Kli Yakar brings, and I don't know where these sources are. It's interesting. It's several times I've seen him quote Arab sources, Yishma'elim, and he says that Yishma'elim have a tradition that Malka Shava was sent back home via Shadim. We know that Shlomo HaMelech had control of these somewhat supernatural forces, and basically, they turned and they were there. That's the Lashma Tevetel. And Shlomo's capacity was so great that he was not just able to send one person back home via the Shadim, but her and her entire retinue and all the Avadim and the whole crew were sent home. In fact, according to this Arab source, he first transported her furniture to Yerushalayim and her bed. You know, they used to recline on these like beds, you know, appeared in Shlomo's palace. And she said, how did you duplicate this? Looks exactly like the one I have back home. How did you duplicate it? And he said, this isn't a duplicate, this is it. And she sat down in her bed, and the Avadim sat down in wherever they sat down, and boom, he transported them back home. So a little bit of a flashy ending, just in case she wasn't sufficiently impressed until that. Somebody told me last week that there are in Africa certain tribes that attribute their ancestry to this Malka Shva, and that they have certain customs, like not eating pork, you know, and some other things. I forgot what he told me, but it's a few customs that seem to have their origins in the Torah. They don't have any claim to being Jewish, but they are claimed to be descendants of Malka Shva. Okay, we'll start the next pasuk. Now we have a description of the vast sums of money that Shlomo had or was getting. The weight of the gold that Shlomo acquired in 1 year, Sheish Meos Shishim Vashesh Kikar Zahav. That's 666 Kikar Zahav, which somebody calculated for me would come out to hundreds of millions of dollars. That's how much he acquired in a single year, besides various things we'll listen to in the next pasuk. There's a machlokas mefarshim here. Let's do the two pasukim together. Levad me'anshe ha'torim, besides the merchant, traveling merchants, and mischar ha'ochlim, and the traveling salesmen, who paid sales taxes. So this is besides the money that was acquired through sales taxes. The chol malchei ha'arev, and all the subservient kings, upachos haaretz, and the officers of the land, who paid tribute. So one explanation is, and this is the Ralbag, he says that this is an annual sum. On an annual basis, he used to get 666 kikar zahav, besides the taxes that were imposed on the merchants, the sales taxes, and the tributes paid by the kings and officers of surrounding countries. So where did this 660 kikar of gold come from? That's from the people who came to ask requests or advice of Shlomo, and you bring a gift to the king when you come. So that added up to this vast sum. So this is an annual basis, the amount that was taken in by Shlomo HaMelech on an annual basis. Others say the 666 is a one-time event. That was this year that they had the money from Ophir and from Malkus Sheva, as well as other sources that add up to 666, and then they agree that the rest were the taxes. The difference between Tarim and Rochlim, the Malbim explains, Tarim are like the big merchants, the wholesalers, and Rochlim are the retailers. So notice you had a value-added tax and a sales tax. I'm not quite sure how they matched up, but that was the various collections. There's no mention of any income tax, however. So I don't know, those candidates who wanted to replace income tax with sales taxes or value-added taxes do have a precedent from Shlomo HaMelech. So that is the description of the wealth, and we'll save it next week to discuss why, in fact, the pasuk goes to such great lengths to go into the details of Shlomo's wealth.